Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I don't want to see the taxpayers taken advantage of. And I don't want to see the taxpayers paying performance bonuses that shouldn't be paid. How do you pay a CEO a performance bonus when, by definition, the institution was failing? What did they do to deserve that money? And this is not a little bit of money. 20 million, 30 million, 700 people were made millionaires by Merrill Lynch, while the taxpayers are paying through the TARP program.
Hey, Wally, pass the wine. It is Godfather Nation. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Now, we open the show today with an incredibly wonderful soundbite from Attorney General Andrew Cuomo in New York, who's really doing the right thing, by pointing out the excessive bonuses that were paid out while the company was getting a bailout. He's an attorney general who's a Democrat, but he's doing the people's business. Here in California, we have an attorney general whose claim to fame is nullifying the votes of the people. We have an attorney general in New York who's actually doing his job as an attorney general, while here in California, we have an attorney general named Moonbeam who thinks his only job is to cater to special interests such as the gay lobby. But, you know, I got to tell you something. Living well is the best revenge. It was said a long time ago. It was true then. It's true now, and it'll be true in the future. Let me give you an example. Last night after the show, I was a little down because the news is so hard, so depressing. It's wearing on all of us. We're living under the burden of an incompetent wreckage of an administration. They're not ready for prime time. They put up a guy, Timothy Geith, who doesn't know what he's doing. He looks like he should be running a Peace Corps office in Western Samoa. And we're told he's going to manage the Treasury, and he says he doesn't know exactly how he's going to do it yet. He's learning on the job. Then you got Obama, who's a neo-Marxist by, you know, if it walks like one, talks like one, Obama. So it was a depressing, you know, news day. I took a little time after the show, and then I went up to North Beach in San Francisco, where I go very often. And I figured, you know what, I'm not in the mood for a big meal at all. I'm going to stop into my friend's restaurant, the North Beach restaurant, and I'm going to have one scotch because I felt a sore throat coming on. I'll have one drink. So I walk in and I go to the bar. There's Lorenzo, my friend Petroni, the owner. Blah, blah, blah. So I order I think it was a Glenfiddich, 12-year-old, and I get a drink. And we start to, you know, talk and have a good time. He and I really like each other. We've known each other 20 years. One word leads to the other. Naturally, after a drink, I'm already in another mood. And talking to a guy I know, I'm already in another mood. And the restaurant's a nice place to be. So I said, you know what? I think I'm going to stay for dinner. So I said, tell the kid outside, I'm going to keep the car out there. I'm going to stay. So we sit down. I sit at the owner's table. And I don't know if you know what it's like to eat in a restaurant when you're eating with the owner. But it's a pretty amazing experience, particularly as a guy like him. So he said, well, what do you want to eat? I said, no, let's start with a salad. What do I know? So what do you want to drink? Right away, the wine and this. And I don't want to drink any wine after scotch. And I'm insisting, I can't mix the grape and the grain. He says, no, you got to have my wine. You got to have my wine. I said, I cannot go from the grain to the grape. Give me a beer. Give me a Budweiser. That's all I want. So he's drinking his wines. We're eating the salad. He said, well, what do you want now? What do you want now? I said, what do you have now? I said, do you have any chicken feet? So he says, let me tell you about chicken. He says, on my farm, he raises all of his grapes. He raises olives up there for his own olive oil. I went up there when he first did it. I remember when he cleared the land. I'm talking 15 years ago. I went up there in the old caddy, and it was before he cleared the hillsides in Sonoma. Now he's got olives and olive oil and a vineyard. So I've watched this develop. So to make a long story short, he says, well, I got chickens too. I got 70 chickens. I said, well, get me some chicken feet. So he starts to laugh. He says, oh, I got to tell you about my rooster. I said, well, what about your rooster? He's, I gave the rooster three chances to make the chickens have eggs. Three times, he said, the rooster couldn't do it. He said, I broke his neck. He said, I cooked the rooster. So at this point, we're having a great time and this and that. And then what do you want to eat? He said, you want tripe? I said, I don't want tripe. What's tripe? It's intestines? Yes. So he said, all right, I don't want any cow's intestine. I said, my mother used to make it and stuff it. He said, no, Italian style's not stuffed. I said, okay, I don't want it anyway. Let's forget about it. You want osso buco? I said, all right, give me osso buco. Osso buco. One course after another. So we're eating like it's in Italy, and we're talking about sons and daughters and wives, about the past, about the present, about the future. In other words, we're having a good time. And in comes another gentleman who is a television station owner. And so we have this gentleman who's an Irish guy. And well, now we start sitting down. The drinks are increasing in number. And we turn to hard childhoods because the name Obama came up. And this gentleman says, although I'm a conservative, we should give Obama a chance. And I said, come on, we gave him a chance. We gave him a chance. We see what the guy's going to do. And we're arguing this and that, but in a friendly way. So they start talking about how tough their childhoods were. Now we're talking about our childhoods. And to show you what a tough childhood can do, each of the men at that table, myself included, are quite successful. But none of us were given a silver spoon. None of us were given a government handout. So the gentleman, the TV executive, says, let me give you an idea. I come from a family of eight children. There were so many of us. My father didn't know our names. He said, but I know this, that when we came home with our report cards, he'd take each of us individually behind the door, and we'd hear the strap come out and the belt job. And he says, you, get in here. He didn't even know my name. But if the grades weren't good enough, that was the upbringing I had. So we're laughing. Then Lorenzo says, you think that was a tough childhood? He said, try mine. On our farm in Italy, when I was a little boy, it was occupied by the Nazis. They took over our farmhouse, my grandmother, my grandfather, my mother, and I. We were put into the barn. We had to live in the barn while the Nazis lived in our house. And yet, you look at these guys. They came over here with nothing. They started with nothing. And look where they are today, and myself included. And we're talking and having a good time. I don't know what course I was up to at that point or what beer I was up to at that point. Now, you got to understand, and you got to picture this. I'm sitting behind an alcove near the opening, the beginning of the North Beach restaurant, right at the front there behind the alcove. Like the owner's table, I see the two guys I'm sitting with look over to the entranceway and they say, ah, there's the man we were just talking about, the mayor. So I thought they were referring to the former mayor, Mayor Brown. Lo and behold, it's my good friend, Eni Tusum Newsom, who I rail against pretty regularly. So he doesn't know I'm there. He comes around the corner and he jumps back. He's, oh my God. I said, here's your nemesis sitting here, Gavin. So I said, look, Gavin, let me tell you something. I hate your politics, but I like you as a person. You're a nice guy. Why are you so left of center? So he sits down and he has a beer, and we're talking. And you know, there's a story within the story. The story within the story is that even though people may be 180 degrees off from you politically, you got to remember their humanity, or else we will descend into chaos. Now, I recognize that because I'm a full human being, and I'm sure the mayor of the city recognizes that because he's a full human being. But I don't think Senator Tom Harkin recognizes that. I don't think that some of these senators who want to destroy conservative talk radio are full human beings. I think that they are ghouls. Anyway, that's my story. Let's have the Tarantala. This is the Savage Nation. Take your calls at 1-800-449-8255. Remember what I do here. I do a news, views, and a reviews. And if I got to tell the world through a rooster, I'll do it. If I got to tell you the world... Okay, wait a minute. Stop the music. It just dawned on me. I know why I'm playing the Tarantala. I couldn't remember. I said to Lorenzo last night, and the other gentleman, did you ever hear my poem When Pasta Was Spaghetti? He said, no. I said, no, I've been playing it for 15 years on the show. I said, you're Italian. How could you not hear it? He said, no, I never heard it. So he said, well, what is it like? What's the poem like? I couldn't remember my own poem. So, gentlemen, if you can get up the poem When Pasta Was Spaghetti, get it up in the sound archive. Tell me when it's up. Is it ready now? You're searching the digital archive. Okay, wait, don't play it. So I said, I don't know, but the gist of my poem is this. And I mean, I remember now, I'm sitting in a fancy Italian restaurant. I said, the gist of the poem is that when I was a kid, spaghetti was 50 cents a plate in a cheap Italian restaurant. I said, and they called it spaghetti. I said, now that they call it pasta, it's $15.99. Well, they broke into another laugh. Play the poem. The hairy forearms of New York serve you your coffee with a turning gesture, an offering that says drink, eat, enjoy. The wiry Italian in Vincent's clam bar, the one behind the greased over register, the young kid connected who receives his deference from the spaghetti cook older than his gangster father, the spaghetti cook who looks like an old-fashioned doctor from the Bronx with clipped mustache. He actually pulls some noodles out of the pot and eats them as they cook, looking to the grimy ceiling for his tender answer. Well, they used to call it spaghetti. Now it's pasta at $10 a plate. The smoky windows of Romeo's Spaghetti now offers radios and knickknacks. It was 50 cents a plate then, in neon letters that you couldn't miss, even through a fogged-over window on a cold winter's eve. There was life. Marinara sauce that smacked to the sea. Noodles as long as your young arm. Meatballs as fluffy as your dream of them. Bread on the table you'd eat against your parents' admonitions that the meal was coming, the meal was coming. And men, some burly with black hairy forearms whose smiles scared you, and little skinny guys with the look of murder on their faces, and people who slurped their spaghetti straight to their mouths from the plate, one motion like Chinese shoveling rice at mouth with clicking sticks. That was gusto before it became a beer ad. That was taste before it became a synonym for fashion. That was spaghetti before it became pasta. Dino singing Volare. I mean, does it get any nicer than that? I love the word cantare. I mean, that's the way to say cantare. You say cantare, I say cantare. You say potato, I say potato. This is the Savage Nation. Isn't that beautiful? What do I give a... You know, I don't care about these politicians. They're all crumb-bum, creep criminals as far as I'm concerned, with about four of them standing up for the American people. I can't wait till it descends to the level of the Taiwanese parliament where they start punching each other out on C-SPAN. In fact, it'd probably be a good idea to run a pay-per-view of the Taiwan parliament whenever it's in session. I mean, those guys at least jump up and hit each other. I wish we could reach that point here because we have no opposition parties. That's the difference. We have a left party and a socialist party. And then there's four conservatives left in the entire... You know, that's the problem with our system. In Israel, they have many parties. In England, they have the parliamentary system with many representations. We don't have many representation. There is no conservative representation in the Congress. What, one guy gets up and says, are you people crazy? That's a conservative wing of the Republican Party? I don't mind that there's a communist wing of the party that took over the country. I don't mind that there's a neo-Marxist wing of the Democrat Party. I don't mind that there's a gangster wing of the Democrat Party. But where in the world is the patriot wing of the Republican Party? Where's the conservative wing of the Republican Party? Clipped, gone, finished. Clinton and Bush destroyed it. 16 years of careful work. There is no conservative movement in the United States of America. So what you have now is the flood. You know, après moi, you know the whole story, right? Après moi le deluge. That's what you have is the flood right now. Once you've destroyed the opposition, which Clinton and Bush have done, what you have now is the flood. The floodgates to neo-Marxism are open, my friends. Now, the purpose of my story telling you about the good time I had last night in the North Beach restaurant is twofold. I hope you understood the political element of the story. There were several. And mixed in with the rooster and the tripe and the calamari, which I didn't even get to, and the beer. Mixed in with all of that, there was some heavy politics in there. Here you have a guy who came here with nothing, who was a waiter, who now owns a beautiful restaurant. No one gave him a dime. No government loan, no bailout, no TARP money, no stimulus. He saved his money and he worked his way up and he owns a great restaurant. That's the American way. The next table, a man grows up in abject poverty. He's a TV executive, owns stations. How'd he do that? No TARP money, no stimulus, no bailout. The third man at the table, Michael Savage. No TARP money, no stimulus. Instead, the government's saying, drop dead, you can't have a job because you're a white man. Here I am, though. They couldn't keep me down because I kept fighting. What I'm saying to you is tenacity is the survival skill that all men should learn. Tenacity, not a government handout and not a welfare state. That's what I was trying to get at. Now, there was another political element to the story. When the mayor comes around the corner and he sees me and jumps back with a smile, oh, my God, and he sees his nemesis sitting there, he could have gotten out of there. He could have left. We weren't mad at each other. Why should I hate him? Should I hate him for being a left-winger? No, because I will read you If another day. I will read you If by Rudyard Kipling. I will not hate another man unless he is hateful. Now, there are politicians who are hateful. Senator Tom Darkness of Iowa, who you know as Senator Tom Harkin, wants the Fairness Doctrine back. He's now known as Senator Tom Darkin because he wants to bring us into the dark ages where there's no First Amendment. That's a man who should be hated, in my opinion. Any senator or congressman who wants to kill free speech should be hated. That's different than a liberal who understands liberalism. San Francisco, KNEW, Steve, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Thanks, Mike. You know, an avid listener. I'm wondering whether some of the anger toward Obama is not based on the fact that he made typified
during the election. It didn't work. Here's a black man who won. So what are you talking about? I'm a racist because I don't like his neo-Marxist politics?
Maybe he typifies the black person who was picked.
No, maybe he typifies neo-Marxism. Because if you've listened to the show, as you say you have, you'll understand that I have lauded black men on this show before.
Well, but you've invoked affirmative action several times in his story. I believe he typifies.
That's correct. He is a product of affirmative action, and I resent that. That is correct.
Proof of that?
That is correct. He is a product of affirmative action, and I resent that. That is correct.
Admissions to the schools he got to. How do you know that?
How do I know that? How do you not know that? How do you not understand that? What world are you living in?
Logan.
What world are you living in? You don't know anything about college admissions and the punks who run admissions committees? Are you joking? A person of color is given a grade more just for the skin color. You want to get it on, my friend? Let's get it on. Ask any white woman out there who's raising a daughter with an A average what chance she has against a person of color with a B average. You don't have children, do you? What, do you have a turkey baster?
Savage.
Hey, Mambo. Mambo Italiano. Hey, Mambo. Mambo Italiano. Go, go, go. You mixed up a Siciliano. All you Calabrese.
It is the Savage Nation. Living well is the best revenge, and I'm going to hope to God that you can continue to live well by listening to the show. This is Dino with Mambo Italiano. Let me hear this.
Mambo Italiano. Try an angelada with the fish baccalà. And then egg.
That was a simpler time, wasn't it? But now we've descended into the dark ages. God in heaven, here we are. And this is only the beginning of the fall. If you think that this is the end of the fall, we're only 2 weeks into the beginning of the fall, you haven't seen Argentina yet. But you're going to be living in Argentina if this man has not stopped. Now, he may not intend to bring us to Argentina, but it doesn't matter whether that's where he intends for America to end up. That is where he is bringing us. I recognize that Bush greased the skids for this, and I've told you that over and over and over again. And don't you ever forget for 1 second that Michael Savage called Bush a fiscal socialist 9 months to a year ago. So don't tell me I don't know who Bush was. Okay? You've got to understand who you're talking to here. There's another element to the story last night that's quite funny that I got to tell you about. Because it's worth telling. A story is a story. And a story, if it has political connections, fine. If it doesn't, it's still a good story. If it's a good story, it's still worth telling. And I'm going to try and tell it to you. It started out with me ordering a scotch at the bar, but I want to show you how. See, this is the detail of life. Just as in a fine piece of art, it's the detail, my friend, that tells you whether the artist is any good. It's the same in storytelling. So let me go back to a portion of the verbal canvas and put in some more brush strokes. Because it's quite, I don't know if the guy's listening, because if he is, it's not going to be fun. I hope he takes it in stride. I have the scotch. So I don't know what it costs, because he picked up the tab, and I don't like when someone does that, but he did anyway. All right, so I started by telling the owner, Lorenzo, a story of about a month before. It was still warm out, and I was sitting outside his restaurant with a table, and a couple of guys came by, and I'm buying them drinks. So these guys, I buy one guy a drink, he orders an iced tea. I buy another guy a drink, he orders a Diet Coke. Another guy orders a common glass of wine. We're in there about an hour, so there's another guy I know who I actually like a lot, but he's a bit on the schnurrer side. You'll have to look it up. He's always looking, in other words, to glum something and get a freebie, and it's always the most expensive thing on the menu. You know the type. So he comes over. I said, hey, I'll call him John. John, sit down, have a drink. So he calls the waiter over, and he says, I'll have, and he orders the most expensive scotch in the bar. There must be 100 scotches, and he orders one. I don't know what it must have cost, but by the name alone, I knew already it was going to drill me. So I got pissed off. I got mad. It's not that I don't have the money for it, but I don't like being taken advantage of. So I said, excuse me, I got to go to the bathroom. I rush into the restaurant, and I grab the waiter by the arm, and I say, hey, come here, let me ask you something. Whatever he ordered, here's what I want you to do. I want you to bring out a separate check for him. When you bring him his scotch, bring him his bill for his scotch. See, he understands immediately. I mean, real people understand. You don't have to translate. See, got it. I said, the guy's a little bit on. I say, bring. All right, 5 minutes later, out comes the waiter, whips out with a tray, and on it is a scotch, and it's a single ounce, of course. He ordered one scotch. And the guy looks at the bill right away, Mr. Schnarr, because he didn't think there'd be a bill with it, and he sees it's $22. He almost died. He calls the waiter over. He's incensed now. He says to him, but you charged me $22 for this scotch. He says, well, that's what you ordered, sir, isn't it? So he says, well, but it's only a small amount. So the waiter says, yes, but you ordered a single, sir. Would you like a double? In other words, the waiter's already now working him, realizing what's going on. So the funny part is that, okay, he was a good sport. Not only did he do that, but he put my drink on the bill. It cost about $35 for two drinks, whatever. And the guy paid it in good nature. I bought him dinner later on in another restaurant. The story I'm telling is that you got to love people and you got to put up with all of their quirks or idiosyncrasies and still love them. Because if you start judging people, which we all do, by the way, for their foibles or their quirks, and you reject them because of the foibles and quirks, what you're going to do is wind up alone with a TV tray and a cat. You know what I'm saying? Working for Obama in the new window department, you know, making sure that minorities get the windows redone. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. You can see I could care less right now. I realize where we're going. We're sliding right into Argentina. And no one's talking about the big missing question. With all the geniuses in the Senate and the Congress, with all the arguments and the pontifications, and how dare you, why, that's pork. No one dare talk about the so-called 400-pound gorilla, to use a commonality. Now, what is the real reason we are bankrupt? Well, it's the I word. The illegal alien is the real reason. What you got to do is you got to go to michaelsavage.com. I think it's still up. If it's not, I'm going to read it to you. And here it is. It's third up from the bottom right. Why are we bankrupt? It says, you think the war in Iraq cost us too much? Well, how about this? Not one senator or congressman told you that $11 to $22 billion a year is spent on welfare for illegal aliens by state governments. That $2.2 billion a year is spent on food assistance programs such as food stamps, WIC, and free school lunches for illegal aliens. $2.5 billion a year is spent on Medicaid for illegal aliens. $12 billion a year is spent on primary and secondary school education for children here illegally and they cannot speak a word of English. $17 billion a year is spent for education for the American-born children of illegal aliens known as anchor babies. $3 million a day is spent to incarcerate illegal aliens. 30% of all federal prison inmates are illegal aliens. $90 billion a year is spent on illegal aliens for welfare and social services by the American taxpayers. $200 billion a year in suppressed American wages are caused by the illegal aliens who work for less. The illegal aliens in the United States have a crime rate that's 2.5 times that of white, non-illegal aliens. In particular, their children are going to make a huge additional crime problem in the U.S. During the year of 05, there were 4 to 10 million illegal aliens that crossed our southern border. You want to see how many illegals came from terrorist countries? The National Policy Institute estimated that the total cost of mass deportation would be between $206 and $230 billion, or an average cost of between $41 and $46 billion annually over a five-year period just to get rid of them. In 2006, illegal aliens sent home $45 billion in remittances to their countries of origin. There are nearly 1 million sex crimes committed by illegal immigrants in the United States. It's an epidemic. The total cost that I've added up for you is $338 billion a year directly tagged to illegal aliens. Did you hear what I just said? $338 billion a year to sustain the cost of illegal aliens. And yet in all of these debates, did you hear one congressman or one senator say we've got to clamp down on all of these costs for illegal aliens? My friends, you have lost your nation. You don't even understand what's going on. This is the Savage Nation. If you care to comment on any of this, the phone number is 1-800-449-8255. If you care to comment on the other big article, which is Senator Tom Darkin of Iowa, who wants to bring back the unfairness doctrine, you can call about that. He's not going to get anywhere, by the way, because I'm going to fight them to the Supreme Court, and I'm going to win. The day they try to do it, I'm going after NPR. I'll make them put me on NPR. The day they do it, I'll go after NBC. I'll make them put me on NBC. The day they do it, I'll go after CBS and make them put me on CBS Evening News. The day they do it, I'll make them put Michael Savage opposite Katie Couric, where every line that the hag says, she's going to have me say my line. It's not workable. They're just trying to scare stations. So I'm ready to fight them. You got to understand that. I am ready to go after them. You understand this? 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. This is the Savage. Give me some Tarantella for a minute. I need a breather, then I'll come back and take your call. No break now, just music. That's it. No break, just a breather. Do your radio. You can take a breather when you need to. You can't do that on television. They see everything you do on TV. That's why they look so horrible. Rough business television. It is, with the eye makeup. Are you kidding me? The pancake. I can't take it. I don't like your... I don't like pancake makeup. I never went for eyeshadow myself. And the makeup on the face, it makes me sweat, you know. Florida, Ann, you're on the Savage Nation. Welcome to the program.
Hello?
Ann, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. I called to say thank you very much for what you're doing. If it wouldn't be for you, I wouldn't know what's going on and what's flying. That's number one. Number two... How can I help you? How can I help myself by helping?
You can't help me. I don't need any help. Let me put it to you that way. I'm self-sustained. I'm self-sufficient. I believe in Thoreau's writings. Apparently, Obama doesn't believe in Thoreau's writings. He's a neo-Marxist who believes in Karl Marx's writings. See, I'm a neo-Thoreauian. Thank you for the call. That's a new phrase, neo-Thoreauian. You remember when you were in college, if you went to college, you read Thoreau. You know, at least he was popular then. But, of course, with the advent of the commie welfare state, I guess they stopped reading about self-reliance. Emerson actually wrote about self-reliance. He was an earlier American writer. But you need education to understand any of these names. If I say Emerson, you probably think I'm talking about a television set. But I'm not. I'm talking about a great American essayist who wrote a great piece called Self-Reliance. In fact, I'll dig it up for you in a few minutes during the real break. I'll get you what he wrote about self-reliance. And you'll find out that we're no longer living in the America that was built by people who built themselves upon self-reliance. You get this. You understand. Virginia Beach Lewis, welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Savage. How are you?
What's on your mind, my friend?
You had a guy the other day, economist, talking in your show, and you keep saying now about how these countries are becoming the new Argentina. And I wanted to talk to you about that because that's how I feel ever since Bush started with this bailout, and now you see Obama doing the same thing. And I mean, these people.
So, are you an Argentinian who's moved here, Lewis?
Yes, I moved here in '87 when Reagan was president. Thank God. And I was running from the same thing we're going through right now. I mean,
yeah, many people who have lived through socialism tell us we are descending into socialism. In fact, we're a good percentage there. But remember, we were 60% there under Bush, even before the bailouts. Bush was already moved us towards socialism with the gigantic government, with the increased welfare, with money for Africa and AIDS. He was already becoming turning us into a welfare socialist nation. So now already we're moved to 10-15% more. God knows what's going to be left after a few more months of this, Lewis.
Well, you know what really, really worries me is there is something that happened in Argentina many years ago that Perón really changed the mentality of the people and made them depend on government.
You're talking about Evita Perón and her husband, Mr. Perón, the Peronistas?
That's correct.
Evita Perón came along and she started to appeal to the masses, the have-nots, and she took from those who had something and built it out of hard work, and she gave it to them. Of course they loved her.
That's right. And I can see Obama doing the same thing. I can see the people.
Absolutely. Here. Obama is clearly a neo-Marxist, and there's no question that that's where he's going. And if we had an opposition party, they would slow him down, but apparently they haven't, Lewis. Thanks for the call. 1-800-449-8255. Chicago, Pete, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. I first want to say that I'm the proud wearer of a Savage for President t-shirt, but your story about dinner last night left me with a bad taste at the entrance of Gavin Newsom. I want to ask you, Michael, if Sean Penn had rolled in with Hugo Chavez, would you have said, listen, fellas, we have different politics? But,
no, you know, absolutely not. But there's a huge chasm between Gavin Newsom, the mayor, and Sean Penn. Sean Penn has gone to Cuba and kissed the hand of Fidel Castro. Sean Penn has gone to one dictatorship after another and stabbed America in the back. That's a lot different than a big city liberal mayor, my friend.
I don't agree, Michael. I think that Gavin Newsom has crossed the line between, you know, civil disagreement and irreconcilable differences. And
okay, in what sense?
Gosh, in just about all of his policies. I mean, homosexual weddings that you rail against continually and admirably, for one?
Correct. Absolutely. I totally oppose them, and I told them that.
All right. Well, you know, Mike, I don't know what to say. I just... I would have liked the story.
Well, what should I have done, thrown a glass of wine in his face?
No, certainly not. That would be assault, but I would have liked the story better if you said, you know what, the ambience is kind of dissolved here, fellas. I'll see you later.
No. I don't think you understand that the way to a politician's heart is through his smile.
Again.
Thank you for the call. I'll be right back.
Savage.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much
it
wine,
is
that's
the Savage
amore.
Nation. Yes, the calamari still flowing
bells
through my
ring, blood. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling.
How long is calamari's half-life in the one circulation? Also, I was mentioning before the break, Emerson's Self-Reliance, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And the key thing I remember from Ralph Waldo Emerson, which is a little off the point I'm trying to make, is his statement, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines. I remember that from God, we loved that in college. That's those of us who are not foolishly consistent. In other words, those of us who like to run around and be a little wild, we love that line, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And, of course, it still works. But listen to what Emerson wrote when he said, there is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself for better, for worse, as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil, bestowed on that plot of ground which is given to him to till. That's what we're talking about, self-reliance, not the stimulus plan. He didn't ask for the government. Yeah? No kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil bestowed on that plot of ground which is given to him to till. But most of you are welfare cases who think the government owes you a living. And that's sad. You're a loser. You're a broken individual. You understand this? Richmond, Virginia, Brad, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, you're talking, I don't get you live down here in Richmond, but you mentioned the trustworthy ones in Congress. Do you have names of who they are? I mean, obviously.
Yeah, yes, Sessions, Cornyn, DeMint come to mind. Sessions, Cornyn, and DeMint. These guys are still doing the people's business, and they're still acting on behalf of the American people, it seems to me, not on behalf of Wall Street.
Yeah, I wish we had some people like that in Virginia. You know, Mourner was elected to our Senate seat past year, and he was like, I'm going to bring, you know, Virginia politics into D.C., and, you know.
Right. No, I understand. But remember those names, Jeff Sessions, Cornyn, and DeMint. These men still, in my opinion, represent borders, language, and culture. In fact, it was very sad to watch Jeff Sessions on C-SPAN yesterday trying to get a vote on an amendment to this pork barrel bill where the money would not have been spent on illegal aliens. In other words, in the construction jobs that are going to be let, the money would not go to illegal aliens. The construction workers would have to be Americans. They wouldn't even vote on it. Nancy Mussolini would not even permit it to come to a vote. to show you how far we have fallen, to show you how owned these people are. That's it. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines. With consistency, a great soul has simply nothing to do. He may as well concern himself with his shadow on the wall. Speak what you think now in hard words, and tomorrow speak what tomorrow thinks in hard words again, though it contradict everything you said today. Ah, so you shall be sure to be misunderstood? Is it so bad, then, to be misunderstood? Pythagoras was misunderstood, and Socrates, and Jesus, and Luther, and Copernicus, and Galileo, and Newton, and every pure, wise spirit that ever took flesh. To be great is to be misunderstood. Now, how's that for a few words? I was at dinner the other night with a friend, and he said Brahms or Beethoven or Chopin could never have written the music that we're listening to tonight. He said, because they existed in a world without electronics. There was no television, no radio. There were no distractions. This music that you're listening to could only have been written in a time when there was total and absolute silence. I said, you mean no leaf blowers? Yeah, he said, I mean no leaf blowers. And I'm easily disturbed by noise, very, very easily disturbed by noise. I'm constantly in my own world, constantly trying to think about the sermons that I want to give on the Savage Nation. Because in many ways, talk radio fundamentally is a church of free thought. You want to define it in many different ways. This is a church of free thought where free thinkers are welcome. And these are sermons. Make no mistake about it. A good sermon has comedy. A good sermon has tragedy. A good sermon has humor. But most importantly, a good sermon has the human element. If you can walk with kings and never lose the common touch, etc., and so on. And so therefore, if you enjoy these sermons, you've got to understand that guys like Senator Tom Darkin, who wants to bring back the Fairness Doctrine, is a ghoul. Tom Darkin is a man who wants to bring you into the Dark Ages. Senator Tom Darkin wants to darken the airwaves by ending the sermons of Michael Savage. How you people of Iowa could have let this man get so far and not understand how low he has fallen and how low he has taken you is beyond me. I had always thought the people of the Midwest were a good people, and I'm sure they are. How Senator Tom Darkin could try to drag us into the Dark Ages without ramifications is beyond me.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. Now, if you just tuned in, I've got to tell you that I just had a very good hour, and it's very hard to follow an hour like that. Just the natural, organic development of a radio program is hard to tell where it's going to go, where it starts, how it ends up. It's very hard to follow that act. So I do hope you enjoyed the first hour. If you're just joining us, you'll try to have to catch it at another time because it was pretty amazing. In this hour, I'd like to go to the news itself through the sound bites. And I'd like to begin with Senator Tom Darkin. Tom Darkin calling for the return of the Fairness Doctrine. Well, I don't want to play the jerk who interviews him because the jerk's a loser who can't get anyone to listen to his show. So I'm not going to play that. I'd rather just play Tom Darkness himself, if you can segregate that out from the loser who can't get anywhere and wants the government to legislate that you listen to the loser who can't get anywhere. Instead, I'll open with one of my favorite boogeymen, Barney Frank, the man who caused the original meltdown by forcing the government to give loans to unqualified individuals. Here's Barney Frank now in clip 9.
In the interest of getting the system working again, I urge you strongly to cooperate with us, not grudgingly, not doing the minimum, but understanding that there is a substantial public anger, and alleviating that public anger, not with mumbo-jumbo, but with reality, is essential if we're going to have the support in the country to take the right steps.
Well, Barney, you should be indicted, actually. You should be wearing a pointy hat and be forced to walk through the people themselves, as they did in China, as far as I'm concerned. You should be wearing a pointy hat and actually face the people for what you did to this country. But you see, Barney, you come so far that you can make believe you had nothing to do with it, Barney, because you have all the people protecting you. So, but Barney, you can get very far with that now, because it's just amazing how the media works for us today.
Then there's another soundbite you got to hear. Representative Paul Kanjorski, never heard of him, D. Pennsylvania, talks about a strange, frightening phenomenon that there was a $550 billion electronic run on a bank. Now, this is a shocking story because they're not telling us who did it. There are some who suspect they know who did it. Listen to clip six.
Look, I was there when the secretary and the chairman of the Federal Reserve came those days and talked with members of Congress about what was going on. It was about September 15th. Here's the facts, and we don't even talk about these things. On Thursday at about 11 o'clock in the morning, the Federal Reserve noticed a tremendous drawdown of money market accounts in the United States to the tune of $550 billion was being drawn out in a matter of an hour or two.
Okay, next.
The Treasury opened up its
both of them.
Window to help. They pumped $105 billion in the system and quickly realized that they could not stem the tide. We were having an electronic run on the banks. They decided to close the operation, close down the money accounts, and announce a guarantee of $250,000 per account so there wouldn't be further panic out there. And that's what actually happened. If they had not done that, their estimation was that by 2 o'clock that afternoon, $5.5 trillion would have been drawn out of the money market system of the United States, would have collapsed the entire economy of the United States, and within 24 hours, the world economy would have collapsed.
Now, let's start again. We're playing for you something that came up by accident, where Rep. Paul Kanjorski let the cat out of the bag on C-SPAN, and he said someone or some forces drew $550 billion in an hour or two out of the money market accounts. Who do you think that might be? Was it China? Was it an individual known as a money changer who almost broke the Bank of England? Who, in your opinion, is it who had the power to draw down $550 billion in money market accounts? Why are we the people being kept in the dark? Now, that's an important question. I'd like you to join in on that. I'd now like you to listen to Senator Mitch McConnell, who's actually surprising me in his articulateness and how well he is doing. In his following speech, he talks about the Europeanization of America in the wake of the passing of this gargantuan pork barrel bill under Nancy Pelosi and Barack Hussein Obama. Listen to clip 13.
Typically, around 20% of our gross domestic product has been government spending. In France, it's over 50%. In Italy and Germany, it's about 45%. If all of these new spending items that we're in the process of considering go through, that government spending in this country as a percentage of gross domestic product in 2010 could well be just under 40%. This paints a picture of the Europeanization of America. And I know there are many people on the other side who think the French and the Germans and the Italians have got it right. But by maintaining a percentage of GDP and government spending of roughly 20%, we continue to have a vibrant private sector. And we all know this is an emergency. We're all in favor of taking some kinds of action. But I do think it's important to focus on the larger question of where are we going to leave the country in 2 years if we take all of these steps. We've made a dramatic move in the direction of indeed turning America into Western Europe.
Now, as you well know, the super libs want us to become like Western Europe. They think it's paradise itself. I'll be right back.
Savage. strategy will cost money, it will involve risk, and it will take time. But as costly as this effort may be, we know that the cost of a complete collapse of our financial system would be incalculable for families and for businesses and for our nation.
All right, fine. That's the Peace Corps man, Timothy Geithner, who was put in there as a front man for the bankers, the money changers in the temple, to tell us that the sky is falling, that unless they get the bailout money, Mr. Hope, of course, is selling fear. Your man, Mr. Hope, is actually Mr. Fear. He's a fearmonger. Obama's a fearmonger. Make no mistake about it. That's how he just sold a $1 trillion deficit, through fear. Your man, Hope, is really Mr. Fear. So he uses this Peace Corps guy, you know. What do you want me to do? 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Eureka, California. Bill, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mike. See, I was intrigued by the story you told of your experience at North Beach Restaurant. And I got to thinking about why don't you do a Michael Savage tour of San Francisco in a book?
What do you mean? You mean get a hat? Get a hat and ride around on a double-decker bus?
No, it would be a self-guided tour. My wife and I visit San Francisco every
day. Oh, you mean do it? Well, I could do it as a video piece on the internet.
That would be
fun. On my website, you know, where people can go on and say, here I am here, here I am there, that kind of thing?
Well, your favorite places, let's put it that way, whether you're there or not at a particular time, but places.
It's a lot of people have asked me to do that, and I'm actually working in my mind on doing something on my website along the lines of let's say a Saturday night skit. Every Saturday for an hour, I would do something in various places, pre-recorded or live, and people could log on to it if they wish, and, you know, be with me for that hour. I have to set the whole thing up. It's very complicated. And that way people can have a little good time and also work in some political, opinion at the same time. For example, when I walked through the streets last night, I'm getting fed up with the bums in the street. It gets me sick. I got news for you. I have never seen so many filthy, dirty, broken bums in the streets as I do now. And I don't like it. Now, I have no compassion. My compassion was used up a long time ago. I don't like infected people walking around in the gutters. I don't like criminals in the gutters. You know, it's awful. It's just awful to see these people in the gutter like this. Any sane government would, you know, you talk about a stimulus bill. Well, why don't you give the people something for it, I say. Why don't you tell us you're going to take the bums off the streets of every American city and put them into work camps, that you're going to give them a bath, you're going to give them drug treatment. Whatever you have to do, you're getting them off the streets for this $1 trillion. You're going to give the people something. They didn't give us jack. You understand that, Bill.
Well, one of the interesting things is that my wife and I have been doing a Herb Cain tour just on our own based on his articles. And he was talking about the exact same thing in the 1970s.
He was a pretty vile man. Herb Cain, for all of his charm, was a pretty vile man. When I first came on the radio in 1994, he viciously attacked me because he was jealous of me. He didn't want anyone horning in on his act where he thought he was Mr. San Francisco. Let me tell you something. He was a stooge of the government at that time, and to me, he was never a hero. I never liked the guy. I never liked his columns. But look, if you enjoy him, that's your business. I'm considering it. That's all. New York, Richard, you're on the Savage Nation. On to bigger topics. Richard, who took the $515 billion, in your opinion?
In my opinion, I think the entire market took it. I think, Michael, I wanted to explain kind of the history of the money market fund, to put this in context, to explain why there was a panic in September. You got a minute?
Yeah, I want to hear it. I mean, because this is alarming. It makes it sound like China did it.
The money market mutual fund was invented in 1970 by a guy named Bruce Bent. Prior to that, you could not go in the bank and say, I want to open a mutual fund. You couldn't just go buy treasury bonds or treasury bills. There was no vehicle for doing that. Bruce Bent had come up with the idea that we're going to pull together the most conservative investments possible, treasury bills, 3-month, 6-month treasury bills, pull them all together so regular investors can now take share in this. So for 35 some odd years, he was the most, the fund started and other people got in the game, but his fund was always the most conservative, just bought treasury bills. While other funds were buying commercial paper, other funds were buying asset-backed commercial paper. Bruce Bent said, no, we're only going to buy treasury bills. That other stuff is not appropriate for money market funds.
Right.
What happened about a year or two ago, Bruce Bent semi-retired, left the company, you know, to the management of others. And for some reason, which I don't know, they started getting into this whole commercial thing, taking corporate credit risk, which they had for 30 years, so that's our business. So they had bought Lehman Brothers commercial paper. And when Lehman Brothers, they call it breaking the buck, a fund always needs to maintain a dollar NAV. The second that fund broke the buck, which was almost unheard of in the money market world, it's only happened twice in like the past 20 years. When that fund broke the buck, and that being the most conservative fund broke the buck, it just caused sheer panic in the entire money market world. I don't have the dollar figures in front of me, but the money markets are in the trillions of dollars.
But wait, I want to bring the people back. I'm following you. I played a piece where Rep. Paul Konjorski talks about a $550 billion electronic run on the banks in a two-hour period. So what you're saying is these money market accounts, what, people were withdrawing their money?
Yeah, money market accounts allow you to have daily liquidity. So many people simultaneously could have just all called up their bankers or their brokers and said, I want out of this fund.
All right. So you don't think it was one entity such as a sovereign fund?
I don't think it was one entity. But, I mean, as ridiculous as it sounds, $500 billion is not a lot of money in the world of money market funds. I mean, there's trillions and trillions, I think. I don't have the exact figures. I apologize for being ignorant.
But the representative said that it could have collapsed the world economy. Was that hyperbole?
Probably could have been, but it would have been, you know, so, you know, what happens is panic just fuels itself. So,
you're raising a very good point. That's right. And the president is putting us into a panic state, is he not?
I don't disagree with that. I think
in other words, every day he's telling us the sky is falling. Timothy Geithner gets up and says, we don't know what we're doing, but let us do it, or else the world will come to an end. Is that not panic talk?
I think it's panic. In today's Wall Street Journal, in the editorial section, they're comparing Reaganomics to Obamanomics. They're comparing, actually, the New York Post was talking about the recession of 1980, 81. They're saying that was a lot worse than what we're experiencing now. In 1980, 81, you had double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation. We're not seeing anything near what was happening in 1980, 81.
And yet they're using this excuse to expand government spending, bringing us into a European-style socialism. Isn't that fundamentally what they're doing?
I would not disagree with that.
Are you yourself in the financial world, Richard?
Yes, I am.
Well, you certainly know what you're talking about, far more so than I do. I never claim to be an expert, but I know enough to have succeeded where I know that I preserve my money. So let me ask you the next question. I remember I had an expert on last week, the Harvard professor, who said I should not keep my money in T-bills, that I should invest in AAA corporate bonds. What do you think?
That I would disagree with. Treasury bills are liquid, and it's backed by the U.S. government. Well, first off, there are no AAA corporate bonds.
That's what I was told. I went to somebody with that, and they said, what are you talking about? They make up that they're AAA.
Well, not even that. Actual real companies, companies that make widgets for a living or dishwashers or whatever, I think there are four of them left that are considered AAA. And GE...
One of them was GE Capital, and it just so happens GE Capital, rated as a AAA company, is going to receive a large piece of the government bailout.
I'm not sure about the government bailout, but I know that today GE Capital announced that GE was making an infusion to that. But the big talk on the street now also is that GE is either going to lose their AAA rating, they're going to cut their dividend, or both. So to say, put your money in AAA corporates, there is no such thing as AAA corporates. They really don't exist
anymore. So you see, there's no such thing as an expert in the world, is there?
but one thing I forgot to mention about mutual funds, an important point, if I can just bring that back.
Sure.
Most mutual funds are backed by a big financial institution, Bank of America, Citibank. So while funds in the past have broken the buck, the bank will just step in and make up the difference. What happened with Bruce Bent and the Reserve Fund is this was just an independent guy, small shop, you know, a couple dozen people. He did not have the backing of a big financial institution. So when he broke the buck, there was nobody to step in and take that place. So that's why it caused such a panic in the money market.
Richard, you're a very, very articulate man. I wish you were a friend of mine so I could consult with you on a regular basis. Bottom line, are we going to get out of this mess?
I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I wish Ronald Reagan were back.
Wow. Richard, I'm going to send you a gift, Psychological Nudity. It's my gift to you because I appreciate intelligence. And believe me, I can hear it when it appears on the show in such an articulate manner. I hope you keep listening to the program and call on a regular basis to edify us as to the goings-on, because we don't know where to turn, and sometimes the listener himself is more of an expert than the experts who put themselves out there for us. This is the Savage Nation. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Only in America could a unworking mother, not married, have 14 children and expect you to take care of it. What about the physician who took dollars from her to impregnate her, a jobless, husbandless woman with 14 children? How much is the state of California going to pay for this nightmare? Well, nobody knows. Now, Miss Suleiman said she's not on welfare. We're talking about the so-called mother of the octuplets. The 33-year-old unemployed single mother's family is now 14 people, including a set of twins, which were all conceived through in vitro fertilization, all reportedly at the same Beverly Hills Fertility Clinic. As far as I'm concerned, the doctor at the fertility clinic should have his assets seized, and those assets should be used to care for these poor children who are all disabled. I'll stop right there. Let me stop right there. I mean, Kaiser Permanente Hospital, where the 8 newborns remain under care, is taking care of them at a phenomenal expense. They've applied to the state for assistance under the so-called Medi-Cal program. Now, you wonder why California's broke. Well, now you know why America is broke. The irresponsibility of the fertility doctor is one thing. The irresponsibility of a system that just won't say no to the most psychopathic amongst us. When you have judges who may as well be Ku Klux Klan members who say we have to let go of thousands of prisoners because their medical care is not as good as yours, then you understand that the system is not broken, it's insane. Now you understand why my bestseller, Liberalism as a Mental Disorder, is such a national treasure. This is the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Now you know what entitlement is. Now you know what entitlement and enabling delusions are. They have nothing to do with children. You have some idea of what's going on here. Harrisburg, PA. Chad, you're on the Savage Nation.
Mike, when I first heard about that bank run that happened last September, I mean, and he said that it was possibly an individual. George Soros came to my mind. Now, I'm not saying that it is an individual, but if that's the case...
We just disclosed that this man who called, he didn't say it was George Soros. It was a run by people who had money market funds.
Now, if
I don't want to go into it. You know, speculation is one thing. Rational speculation is another thing. Hysterical speculation is another thing. Okay? Austin, Texas. David, welcome to the program.
Mike, on the issue of Bark and Harkin and Stabbin' Stabino.
Let's start using Harkin's new name, which is Darkness, not Harkin. It's Darkin.
I agree, but that's my enunciation of him. You know, they just don't realize that there are so many people, so many patriots out here that are not going to be silenced. There's going to be people.
Wait, what are you going to do about it? If Senator Darkin says, screw you, we're taking conservatives off the air, what are you going to do about it? What are you doing about the stimulus? Tell me what all your patriots are doing about the stimulus. You're watching the country. You're seeing a massive theft in front of your eyes, as I am. What are we doing about it?
Well, I don't know.
Nothing. We're powerless. You're going to sit and clean your gun? Yeah, go sit home and clean your gun. I'm not ridiculing you. We're powerless nobodies. These gangsters are doing what they want. It started with Henry Paulson under Bush. It's continuing under the neo-Marxist Obama. Not one of these so-called senators or congressmen has said, wait a minute, what about the cost of illegal aliens, which I showed you is about $330 billion a year? Have any of them said we're going to stop feeding this pork pie called the illegal alien pork pie mess? Not one of them has said a dollar's coming out of the illegal alien fund. Why is that?
You are so absolutely correct about that.
Because we the people have no power. Because we the people have lost our power. Because we no longer have a representative government, if we ever had it. Did we ever have a representative government? Were you able to meet your representative? What state do you live in, David?
Excuse me?
What state do you live in?
Texas.
Okay, so who is your representative in Texas?
John Cornyn.
Now, John's a good guy, but if you really needed something, you think he's going to represent you?
Well, I doubt it very seriously because special interest is just so deep in Washington that you know they forget about the people that are working. They forget about.
Well, no, Obama didn't forget about the people. A homeless woman came up to him at the meeting and said she needs help to get out of her car, and apparently she got housing today. See how great Obama is?
Oh God,
he's Robin Hood. He's not Robin Hood. He's Robin Hood.
Yeah.
So she went to the head of the line. Because this is a man who really wants to help all the homeless. Now, if the day comes that he has to give houses to the homeless of America, and he goes to liberals in Marin County, California, for example, and the liberals in Austin, Texas, and Westchester County, and he says, no, for the sake of justice and hope and fairness, I'm going to ask you to give up your house so that we can put the homeless in them. Do you think the liberals will give up their houses?
Forget that. It'll never happen.
You know, there was a movie years ago based upon the great novel called Dr. Zhivago. Boris Pasternak wrote it. David Lean made a great movie of it with Julie Christie. One of the great movies of its time. Now, Boris Pasternak's movie is worthy of watching again. Dr. Zhivago tells the story of what happened to the Russian middle class or upper class after Obama took over. I mean, Marx and Lenin and Trotsky took over. You see, when Obama, I mean Trotsky and Lenin and Marx, took over Russia, what happened to this family, Dr. Zhivago's family, was quite interesting. And it might be telling as to what's coming to you, all you good liberals with your Priuses in Marin County, California. You see, in Dr. Zhivago, we see the new administration under the Bolsheviks of Russia telling the people who had that beautiful country house that they were going to now have some new tenants in their house. That the owners of the house were put into the maid's room, and in each room, four families were placed. And that's the story of Dr. Zhivago. And to my good friends in Marin County who think you're so right and so pompous with your Obama-Biden bumper stickers, hey, what would happen if your good friend, Mr. Hope, said to you, now let's see, you're a married couple in your 50s with a house with four bedrooms, but there are no children in three of them. So for the sake of hope and fairness and justice, all you good liberals in Marin County and Westchester and Austin, Texas and Los Angeles, you're going to have to put families in the bedrooms in your house in order to make sure there are no longer any homeless, because I know you want fairness and justice and hope. And so me and my minions, we're going to send the ACORN workers out who are going to be wearing green uniforms. And these ACORN workers are going to make sure that they get into your house and see how many rooms are not occupied. And in these rooms, we're going to put several illegal alien families, and then we're going to put several crack addicts in the other bedroom in your house. And in the other bedroom, we might put some people just released on sex charges, because, after all, I promise change. And I want you people of Marin County, all you Obama-Biden bumper sticker people, to recognize change when you see it. And so those empty bedrooms are now going to be full and be put to use. And we know you won't mind, because you're good people. You voted for me. And you asked for change. And you asked for progress. Well, this is progress. And those empty nesters out there in Marin County and Austin, Texas and Westchester and Los Angeles, you're not going to be empty nesters anymore. You and your wife and your husband, you're not going to be alone in that house and suffering loneliness anymore. We're ending that isolation. So you're going to have illegal aliens in one of the empty bedrooms. You're going to have crack addicts in the other empty bedroom. And you're going to have sex maniacs in the other bedroom. And then you'll know what hope and change can bring. This is the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. MichaelSavage.com has many, many stories that you must see, including my monologue of today, which is, what's my monologue of today, Beowulf? I forgot. I don't even remember. I'm not on my website. I'll have to get it out of the page here. Here it is. Wait. Notes for the Savage Nation. Obama and the flag. Did I tell you about the flag story? A wonderful reporter for the Washington Times called me and asked for a quote from me. Claiming that some people have observed that President Obama seems to be appearing before more American flags than ever before, and that Obama has suddenly started wearing a flag pin. And she wanted to know if Michael Savage had a comment about the newly discovered flags and the flag pin of Obama. And here's what I wrote. It went like this. Neo-Marxists recognize the power of old glory as they steadfastly pursue their agenda.
As Castro taught them, hasta la victoria siempre, always towards victory. As the street agitators themselves know, by all means necessary. To them, our flag is just a rag. And I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the big sound of the Savage Nation. Yep. As he said, if you're going to get raped, you may as well enjoy it. That was Onassis. And he should know because when Aristotle Onassis had been a child as a Greek and the village was invaded by the peace-loving Ottoman Turk Muslims, there was a Muslim officer who liked boys. And apparently Onassis was picked by this officer, and he gave him a choice. It was a sort of a little Sophie's choice, if you know what I mean, where he became Sophie. So I guess that impressed him greatly as to the meaning of the word rape. When your country is raped, you may as well enjoy it. So folks, since we've basically been invaded by thieves and gangsters and criminals in Congress to about a 96th percentile, and since they're robbing us in plain sight, without mentioning $1 less for illegal aliens, even John McShane, the fraud, taking out the Buy American clause. Did you notice that this week? You saw who McShane was, right? McShane worked along with the other cronies to take out the Buy American clause. So we knew who McShane was. It wouldn't have mattered. I mean, if he won, big deal. We knew he was a fraud. At least we have a guy who can speak, who's young now. You know, if you're going to have Marxism, it may as well be somebody who can entertain you along the way with a nice baritone voice. And a little youth. That's why the Repubes ran the old broken horse, because they knew the youth vote would go to Obama, and they certainly wanted the Deems to run with the Marxist football. They didn't want the old fogey to run with it. So there we are. Here we are. Here we are. Well, we're going to become Europe, and then what? Well, it isn't so bad, as long as we only become Europe, right? By degree, is Europe great? Well, let's see what Europe has that we don't have, and let's see what Europe doesn't have that we do have. Let's start with freedom of speech. What you may not know now is that it's illegal to criticize Muslims in many European countries. In any way, if you say one word against Islam or Islamic radicalism, you are an enemy of the state. I don't know if you know that it's illegal to criticize homosexuals in Europe. It's considered a hate crime. So now you understand a little bit more about the agenda, the long-term agenda. But that's not so bad. After all, they have cappuccino and, I don't know, a lot of things that we don't have. Like, well, I don't know what, but they have lots of great things, like a low birth rate because none of the men will get married. The men like to look at themselves instead of looking at their children. And so the birth rate is in negative decline in Italy, the lowest birth rate in Europe. The last I checked, one of the lowest birth rates of all was Italy. The men just won't get married and have children. And, of course, we're not too far behind, but we're catching up. But as we become an increasingly large welfare state and more move toward the EU, we'll have almost no children except illegal aliens. We'll have lots of children. And that's because they're good little Democrats who don't understand the language. And, of course, they'll vote for D, no matter what they're told to do, no matter what's on there, it'll be a D, they're told in their language, go vote with a D next to it. And that assures a welfare state for the, foreseeable future. And so there it is. That's a little bit of a picture of what we're going to have in America, but they have style. After all, we bumpkins in America have no style. Europeans, well, they have great style. Just ask the libs. They love to go over there in Provence, Tuscany. They come back glowing about Europe. Now, of course, what they don't tell you is what the restaurant owner will tell you as you're sitting in Italy, which is that while you're eating in my restaurant, the illegal aliens are robbing my house, that there's a crime wave here in Europe that we can't control, the rapes, the robberies, the murders. 90% of them are committed by illegal aliens. That doesn't make it to the International Herald Tribune, and it certainly doesn't make it to the liberal lexicon of what's wrong with Europe. No, no, all you hear about is the wonderful food, the fabulous, fabulous food. Dionysus himself would have loved it. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Chris in San Diego, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. Great first hour. On the topic of why California is broke, you mentioned $330 billion in this illegal immigration. I wanted to know where I could reference those numbers that you brought up.
Good. You know, I'm glad you asked, because you're saying, did I just make them up? If you're going to go to my website, you'll find it. It's being moved up to the third article on the right. But right now, on michaelsavage.com, where is it? It's called here. Where did it go? I don't know. It got dropped? I don't believe it. I'm talking about it. It's gone? Top. It's at the top now. We're on the top. I don't know where it is. Here it is. On the right side of my website, you're going to see my monologue, then a picture of my book, Psychological Nudity, then The High Cost of Illegal Aliens, right? If you click on that article and you hear my statements, each one of the statements and the costs has underneath it a link to the verification. And this came from Americans for Legal Immigration. They had it on their website. And, for example, $11 to $22 billion is spent on welfare to illegal aliens each year by state governments. And it says verify at, and it gives you the website, which you just hit the button and click to it. You follow me? And then for the next one, $2.2 billion a year is spent on food assistance programs such as food stamps, WIC, and free school lunches for illegal aliens. You can click and go right to the verification. $2.5 billion a year spent on Medicaid for illegal aliens. Click, you can find out the verification. $12 billion a year spent on primary and secondary school education for children here illegally, and they cannot speak a word of English, and so forth and so on. And yet in all of this talk about a stimulus, did even one Republican say we must assure the American taxpayer none of this money will continue to go for supporting illegal aliens? Not one word about medication or education being cut for illegal aliens. So it's finished. It's over. And that's why I quoted Aristotle Onassis, where he said, if you're going to get raped, you may as well enjoy it. And that's why I opened today's show with the Tarantala and a talk about living well is the best revenge. You know, you understand the bigger picture, Chris?
I understand. Hey, I had one more thing, if I might. I'm enjoying the sermon today. You know, I love when you come in with those, the songs like When the Moon Hits Your Eye. Like, my dad used to have a tape of all Italian songs, because we're Italian. And he used to
Isn't that beautiful? Well, I know. I'm kind of like the uncle of American broadcasting. I'm older than most people in broadcasting, and I'm proud to admit that I'm still going strong. But, you know, I don't realize time has marched on. I've been at this for 15 years, and it turns out now I think I'm actually the oldest person in the winner's circle. I'm older than Rush. I'm older than the Leprechaun. I'm older than the Wallbanger. And I'm still going strong, you know, and I hope that God gives me the strength to keep going a few more years. But the fact of the matter is, Chris, I do come from another time, and I can't pretend to be 20 years old because I'm not 20 years old.
Well, we're out here listening, Michael, and we appreciate it.
I know. And many guys who've lost their fathers or their uncles, even if they don't agree with me politically, I remind them of a time in America that was so much better, and they know it, and they want to listen to the show. And, you know, I don't want to go into the hearts and flowers. Play That's Amore for a minute. Thanks for the call.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Wait, I'm going to make you a promise, though. If the day comes that I start to sound like Larry King, where you can hear him swallowing, I'm out. The day comes when I actually sound like that. I think Larry King passed away during the time of Moses, and they used a certain kind of biblical wax to keep. I don't know what it is, but he certainly looks like he was around during the time of Moses. I think he walked the earth when Moses did. He was a cohort of Moses when Moses was around. Larry King was a mere lad. But the day comes, you know, you can tell when a geezer is old in radio or television. There's a certain sound that starts coming out of their voice, like a liquid, like a lot of fluid in their mouth. I don't know what that is. They start to, like, salivate a lot. I don't know what, the teeth maybe? You think it's the Martha Ray choppers he may wear? I don't know, but there's an awful lot of, they swallow a lot. Like, I don't know, I'm getting on, I'll have to think about this, what it is with the geezers and in the media. But who's the oldest person in the American media still hanging on? Isn't it the Larry King who can't get enough of the perverts and the dictators of the world? Another one, Sean Penn with suspenders. So, my son is 9 years old. He wants to be black. Larry, you piece of garbage, you. You low-life gutter rat, you. You didn't tell your son? You know, if a black man's son came home and said, Dad, I want to be white, you'd expect a black man to say, Son, that's not the right thing to feel. You are what you are. You should be proud of what you are. But not Larry King. He doesn't know what the word pride is, apparently. So when his 9-year-old son comes home and says, after Obama wins, I want to be black, Larry King goes, there's a lot of advantages to that. That kind of, you know, druggy Miami laugh. Anyway, it's one man's opinion. You don't like it?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Like any negotiation, this involved give and take, and if you don't mind my saying so, that's an understatement. But the agreement we've reached stays faithful to the principles I've outlined. I'm really at a lack of words how to express my admiration, respect, for the love of our country, the patriotism, and the courage of three brave senators. Specter from Pennsylvania, Snow and Collins from Maine. I don't think I need to say more than that. The middle ground we've reached creates more jobs than the original Senate bill and spends less than the original House bill. This bill creates 3.5 million jobs.
I'm sick of this. I was watching TV earlier today when I saw a vision that disturbed me. Harry Reid was on the TV announcing that the House and Senate had reached a deal on the so-called pork barrel bill. Hovering behind him were the faces of Joe Lieberman and Max Baucus. To me, there were three faces of evil floating on the TV screen. It was a nightmare vision of Mount Rushmore. Eventually, the disgusting visage of Arlen Specter came to the fore, and you could see in the lines of his face what over 30 years of continuous backstabbing, deal-making, and selling out will do to a man. You talk about the portrait of Dorian Gray. Play the clip.
This is obviously a very difficult vote in view of the large deficit in national debt which we have. But I believe it is indispensable that strong action be taken.
Yeah. Specter drawled on until Lieberman came to the fore. Lieberman's eyes were only half open, as if he was some sort of senatorial somnambulist, sleepwalking through his speech.
We came a long way in a relatively short time to achieve something big and urgently necessary for our country and our people.
Then there was Susan Collins, who affects a shaky voice as if to make people think she's ill, for sympathy ploy.
Today we have shown that working together, we can address the enormous economic crisis facing our country. I'm particularly pleased that we have produced an agreement that has a top line of $789 billion.
And then came Olympia Snow, who looks like Snow White after smoking two packs a day for 50 years.
Given the gravity of the circumstances economically, I thought it was important to be part of a process that could yield a consensus-based solution to achieving an approach at this most critical time in our nation's history.
All of them saying how important the stimulus package is. All of them saying how hard they had worked for the American people. And all the while knowing in their hearts how much they were betraying the American people. They know they all get something out of it. Reid probably inserted bailout for whore houses. No doubt Senator Daniel Inouye has a stimulus package for ukulele factory in Hawaii. And maybe the good citizens of the state of Maine will get a lobster stimulus from Senator Collins and Senator Snowjob. These people are pure evil, in my opinion. This is the biggest bilking of the public in the history of this country. We have a president who promised no earmarks, and he's giving us more earmarks than we've ever had before. We have a Treasury Secretary who is a tax dodger and has no idea what he's doing to the American economy. We have a Senate full of evil men. We have a Senate full of cronies, not necessarily working for the good of the people. Okay, moving on. The elections in Israel were very close and somewhat confusing. Joining us now to help straighten out the results and what they may mean is Aaron Klein with WorldNet Daily in Israel.
Well, Michael, here in Israel, we had national elections yesterday, and the results were a little bit surprising to Israelis. And I'll tell you, I know that me here in Jerusalem, I'm 5,000 miles away, and you might think that what goes on in the Israeli elections has very little to do with the United States, but it actually has major ramifications for the U.S. and for the White House, and I'll explain why. So yesterday we had elections, and late at night, actually early this morning, we finally got the results, and they were surprising. They showed, basically, we had three candidates running for office. You had the opposition leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's the former prime minister, running against Tzipi Livni, the foreign minister of the current Kadima government. And then you had the third candidate is Ehud Barak, the defense minister of Israel. And in Israel, in the dysfunctional political system that is the Jewish state, the Israelis don't elect a leader directly. What they do is they elect a party. And based on which party gets the most seats in the 120-seat Knesset, the leader of that party then goes on, if he can form a stable coalition with other parties, he then goes on to become prime minister. So the results are in, and Tzipi Livni's Kadima party got 28 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Bibi Netanyahu got 27 seats for his party in the Knesset, and then other parties got lesser seats. So in other words, Livni's Kadima party has one more seat in the Knesset than Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. So Bibi Netanyahu is going to have to be tasked, and so is Livni, with talking to the other parties, and whoever can form the most stable coalition will then probably be recommended by the Israeli president. According to law, he has to recommend that person to then form a government. So it all comes down to one particular party. It's called the Yisrael Beitanu party. It's led by somebody named Avigdor Lieberman, and he, Lieberman, has espoused ideology and politics that are closer to Netanyahu's party, so it's likely he's going to side with Netanyahu and then form a coalition, but he could also go, depending on whether he gets promises and pledges from Livni, with the Kadima party.
Well, what are the real differences between these parties?
You have Kadima and the Livni party, and she pushes for continuation of talks with the Palestinians, leading to the creation of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, possibly in eastern Jerusalem. She wants to continue talks with Syria, leading probably to the relinquishment of the strategic Golan Heights. And then you have Netanyahu, who says that he opposes territorial concessions, although in 1996 through 1999, when he was prime minister, he signed away strategic territory. And I have specific information that he's already sent out feelers to the Palestinians, to Syria, that he would continue in engagement and talks with both the Palestinians and Syria. So when it comes to giving away territory, I'm not really sure which leader, Livni or Netanyahu, have different policies. But there's one thing in specific that differentiates Bibi Netanyahu from the others, and this is how it could affect the United States. Bibi has made clear that as prime minister, his primary goal, his singular goal, will be, or his major goal, will be to halt Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. Whereas Tzipi Livni, the Kadima leader, has really not espoused any policy, coherent policy, when it comes to Iran. So should Benjamin Netanyahu become the next Israeli leader, that is, if he's able to form a stable coalition, which looks very possible, then obviously these could have very strong ramifications, and Netanyahu is going to have very difficult decisions to make, because he'll have in the White House, as you know, Michael, he'll have a president, Barack Obama, who continues to and wants to push for engagement and dialogue and direct talks with Iran. So Netanyahu will have to decide, does he give Obama a chance and does he give these talks a chance? Of course, knowing that the talks can obviously be used as a smokescreen for Iran to continue to go nuclear, or does Bibi attack Iran without explicit permission from the White House, from the State Department, from the Pentagon? One thing I really do feel strongly, knowing Bibi and also knowing a lot of people close to him, is that when it comes to Iran, I think that we're going to see him act. We're going to see him attempt to go after Iran in one way or another. So things are going to get interesting. Right now, in Jerusalem, the politics have one big question mark. But for now, this is Aaron Klein with an exclusive report for the Savage Nation.
Well, Aaron, thanks for the report. Let's hope for the best. This is the Savage Nation. I'll be right back. Savage. The Fairness Doctors. Liberalism is on the assault again. Leftists are coming out of the woodwork to attack conservative talk radio. Chairman Obama said the other day that you can't get things done by listening to Rush Limbaugh. Debbie Stabenow in the back note declared that she wanted hearings on radio accountability. And today, Senator, harking back to the old times, said that we need the Fairness Doctrine. I want you to listen to some of these voices of hatred.
Thanks for your leadership. Thanks for your good work. It's great to have you there, Senator, and great to have you on the show. Appreciate it.
Well, anytime. Just let me know, Bill. I love being with you. And thanks again for all you do to get the truth and the facts out there. By the way, I read your op-ed in the Washington Post today. I ripped it out. I took it to my office. I said, there you go. We've got to get the Fairness Doctrine back in law again.
Disgusting. A generation ago, liberals said, I may disagree with you, but I'll fight to the death for your right to say it. Today, liberals say, I disagree with you, and I'll fight to the death until your right to say it is taken away. The illiberals are coming closer and closer to dismantling the First Amendment entirely. The Fairness Doctors, who wish to impose the Fairness Doctrine, are about to perform a surgery on our Constitution from which the body politic will never recover. And furthermore, the American people themselves are completely opposed to it. Poll after poll has demonstrated to the American people that even if they were tricked into voting for Chairman Obama, are in favor of freedom of speech. We have not yet fallen that far into communism yet. But the Fairness Doctors have other plans for us. They're all for freedom of speech, just as long as it praises Chairman Obama. They're all for freedom of expression, so long as no doubts are expressed about the stimulus package. They want you to be able to say whatever you want, as long as you say what they want. The only problem is democracy doesn't work without dissent. It doesn't work without naysayers. And I, Michael Savage, Dr. Dissent, refuse to back down. The Republicans may have rolled over to Specter, Collins, and Snow, and they may go along with this. And the editors of the Meekly Standard may be dining with Chairman Obama, but I won't. We must stop the Fairness Doctors before they kill our country. Now back to another thing that I was talking about. Why are we so surprised at what Obama's doing? This is not a presidency. This is a coup we're watching. We're watching a coup occur right before our eyes. They're melting down the financial system. This is all orchestrated. And by the way, the Republicans are in on it as far as I'm concerned. George W. Bush greased the skids for Chairman Obama. What George W. Bush started, this man is going to finish. And both parties are doing it at the bidding of the International Monetary Fund and other forces who want to see the dignity, the hegemony, the distinction, the separateness of the United States of America disappear so that we as a card can be rolled into the new deck called the New World Order, that we become one of many cards in the new deck that these neo-Marxists can play with. They do not want a strong nation defined by borders, language, and culture. Now that is the conservative viewpoint. Make no mistake about it. The conservative viewpoint is what I just expressed, not what these frauds on MSNBC or Fox News are telling you is the conservative viewpoint. They may as well be Arlen Specter. Those fake conservatives on Fox News may as well be Arlen Specter, as far as I'm concerned. What I just told you is what the true conservative opinion is. I had mentioned earlier that when Obama replaces Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which no doubt will happen in the next few years, if not sooner. It could be Schumer who goes on the U.S. Supreme Court. That has been this man's wildest wish and dream ever since he was a mere boy in Brooklyn, I can assure you. So if you think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been radical, you are right. But you've seen nothing compared to what will happen once the next one gets on the Supreme Court. Well, here's what's on michaelsavage.com. Number one is my monologue, The Faces of Evil, which you've got to read that. The faces of Harry Reid, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, and Charles Lieberman, whatever his name is, Joe Lieberman, is enough to provoke fear in the heart of the devil itself. On the left side of the page, there's a fabulous Ramirez cartoon from the New York Post that shows Obama with big ears, where he says the stimulus bill does not have a single earmark in it, and his big ears are shown to contain all of the earmarks that are in it. Our great one himself, the Chairman Obama, says this stimulus bill has no pork and not a single earmark. Ramirez shows his big ears containing $2 billion for a Matteson, Illinois coal plant, $2 billion, $10 million for urban canals, $2 billion for advanced batteries for hybrid cars, $255 million for a polar icebreaker, $6.2 billion to weatherize your windows, $15 billion for a Pell Grant expansion, $1.2 billion for youth summer jobs, $380 million for a nutrition program. Can you believe this? Acorn, $5.2 billion for community development block grants. That means the gangsters of Acorn. $650 million for digital TV coupons, $2 billion for federal child care, and so forth and so on. Obama is a liar, 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 pants on fire. How the media lets him get away with this is anyone's guess. Also on michaelsavage.com, the offices of the three turncoats in the GOP who went along with the Marxists have been barraged with phone calls and emails, but they could care less. Then there's Senator Harkin. Senator Harkin says that we need the Fairness Doctrine back. If you look at Senator Harkin's face, it looks like he runs a cat house in his home state. This guy is the true face of evil. Only there's no Orson Welles here. There's only his own genetics. Newsweek's cover. We are all socialists now. That's right, you heard me. You disparaged me when I said Obama would install socialism. You disparaged me when I said Obama's a neo-Marxist. Newsweek says on their cover magazine, we are all socialists now. This is the Savage Nation. Here's what we talked about today on the Savage Nation, Obama and the flag. Today I was asked for a quote by a reporter. She said some observers are claiming that Obama seems to be appearing before more and more American flags, and he now even wears a flag pin. She wanted to know if I thought he had newly discovered the power of traditional patriotism, or is old glory just being used as the ultimate photo op? Well, here was my response. Neo-Marxists recognize the power of old glory as they steadfastly pursue their agenda. As Castro taught them, hasta la victoria siempre, always towards victory. As the street agitators themselves know, by all means necessary. To them, our flag is just a rag. The Fairness Doctrine was next. You see, the ultra-commie libs are pushing the Fairness Doctrine. The TV networks have more or less fallen in line. The newspapers have fallen in line a long time ago. But conservative talk radio won't budge. So Chairman Obama and the U.S. Marxist Senate wants to push a little harder. Now, if Chairman Obama makes an all-out push for the Fairness Doctrine, will the Republicans find the backbone to stand up to him at last? Or are the American people stupid and drugged up enough to destroy freedom of speech? Then we talked about the stimulus itself. The faces of evil in the Senate striking a deal on the stimulus bill. Geithner at Treasury wants even more. The socialist David Obey says it may not be enough. Is the U.S. entering the dark ages? Bailout after bailout, stimulus after stimulus. We are creating enough debt for our children's children's children. FDR showed spending our way out of a recession doesn't work, and Obama seems set on following FDR's government spending spree. Joining us now is Wayne Allen Root to talk about Obama's spending and the problems he sees coming along with it.
Thanks, Michael. You know, for weeks I've been nonstop in the media talking about the disaster of the Obama Economic Stimulus Plan, otherwise known as the $1 trillion Socialize America Plan. Hosts love to say to me, what would you do, Wayne Root? You have to do something. What's your plan? Well, my answer is, no, you don't. I love to tell the story of the Congressional Effect Fund. The Congressional Effect Fund has done a 50-year study of the link between the United States Congress, their actions, and the economy. And what they found is, over the last half century, when Congress is in session, the stock market is up 1.7%, and when Congress is out of session, the stock market is up 17.6%. More proof that when politicians do something, anything, it often makes it worse for all of us. Politicians do damage to the economy every time they open their mouth, every time they make a decision, every time they pass a bill. We need a new Hippocratic oath for politicians called, above all else, do no harm. You know what this is about? Ego. And most of all, lawyers. That's a bad combination, ego and lawyers. Lawyers have huge egos. They want to prove they're smarter than everyone else. They want to prove they have the answers to everything, that they know it all. Even if they know nothing about the topic, they have to prove that they know more than you. That's what they learn in law school, how to take control of every deal, get in the middle, play big shot, and then they screw it all up. They ruin every deal they touch. Lawyers kill deals in the business world every day. And the same thing holds true in the political world. The problem is Obama's a lawyer. His wife's a lawyer. Even worse, they're Ivy League lawyers. Almost every congressman and woman is a lawyer. They have the biggest egos in the world. And they can't let any problem go untouched, even if they have no idea how to solve it. Even if their solutions will make it far worse. They don't care. They have to get in the middle of it to prove how smart they are, how powerful they are, how invincible they are, how much more brilliant they are than the rest of us, to prove that we can't live without them, to prove that the world revolves around them.
True.
Lawyers, politicians, that's the problem. Look at Obama's statement. He said the only way out of this crisis is with government. Government. See, he thinks there is no other way except Obama. Well, I may be just a citizen politician and homeschool dad, but sometimes I believe nothing is better than doing something that makes things worse. Look at the Iraq War. We rushed to invade to stop Iraq from using weapons of mass destruction, and that was $1 trillion ago. Look at the bailout. The same words being used now by Obama were used by politicians back then. We must act, or there will be a catastrophe. Well, we acted, and what did we get? A catastrophe! We spent $9.7 trillion bailing out big-shot Wall Street executives and bankers who turned around and gave billions in bonuses to themselves. We now have $9.7 trillion in new debt. We have no accountability. Credit markets still completely frozen. No loans for the common man. Housing still plummeting. The stock market still crashing. The economy still in tatters. Companies who got bailouts coming back for more bailouts. And just the other day, GM and Chrysler announced they may need to go into bankruptcy protection to protect themselves from the government asking for the loans back. Well, this has just worked out wonderful, don't you think? But don't take my word for it. Ask the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. They agree exactly with my philosophy. You see, the CBO, which is made up of policy wonks, economists, and math whiz kids, completely nonpartisan. All they do is read the numbers, study the numbers, and report the facts. No hyperbole, no politics, no selling. The CBO reported just a few days ago that Obama's economic stimulus package will do no good and, in the long run, will actually cause harm. More harm than if we do absolutely nothing. The CBO reported that in the short term, there might be a slight uptick to the economy, there might be a slight increase in jobs, but by 2011, the effects would be virtually nil, nothing, nada. But in the long term, the news is even worse. You see, Obama's trillion-dollar economic stimulus will create dangerously high debt, create lower GDP, which is our gross domestic product, than if government did nothing at all, and it will add billions in interest to service that sky-high debt.
I'm sick of this.
But worst of all, it will cost the private sector billions of dollars in available capital. See, if government crowds out the private sector and they suck up all of the available capital, there's nothing left for private enterprise, thereby in the long run costing jobs and lowering gross domestic product output of American business. They didn't even mention the CBO that there would be higher inflation, higher taxes, higher interest rates, and a loss of free markets and capitalism. They didn't even mention that Obama's jobs, the few jobs that they credit him with maybe creating, are all government jobs. 600,000 new federal employees, 100,000 new teachers, and $200 billion going to state and local governments to save the jobs and even the salary increases of millions of state and local employees. Just what we need. More government employees, more union members, more government spending, more bloated salaries, more pensions, and more health care commitments for life. When this stimulus is long gone, all those 700,000-plus salaries, pensions, and health care commitments for new government employees will still be around for the next 50 to 60 years. Here in Nevada, where I live, Las Vegas, the police chief just retired at 47 years old, and he will get a six-figure pension and health care for the rest of his life. If he lives to 87, we, the taxpayers, are on the hook for $150,000 a year for the next 40 years. And he doesn't even work. He's playing golf. No wonder we're broke. Do you realize the federal government retirement system has an unfunded liability of $5.3 trillion? That's just the unfunded portion. And that's just federal employees. That doesn't count state and local. Obama's answer is to add more government employees, more debt, more spending, more unions. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Obamaville.
It's insane. Only a more savage nation can survive, and here we've turned to the left. Huh.
It's the same prescription as FDR back in the 1930s. But no one seems to remember the result of FDR's solutions and government interventions. The worst depression in history, over a decade long, massive debt and unemployment 10 years after FDR took over, as high as 15%. The only reason we got out of the depression eventually was World War II. FDR never got us out of it. His gigantic spending programs never got us out of it. His pro-union policies never got us out of it. His high taxation only made things worse. Pearl Harbor is what got us out of it. No, I think I'll pass on Obamaville. I'll pass on sky-high debt, sky-high deficit, sky-high inflation, sky-high interest rates, sky-high taxes, and Big Brother taking over our economy and our lives. Personally, I think doing nothing is a far better alternative. But then, I'm not a lawyer. I'm Wayne Allen Root at RootForAmerica.com. Back to you, Michael Savage.
Thanks, Wayne. We're looking at generations of debt now when they could have just left things alone. I'll be right back. Be here or be nowhere. Savage. Europe is under attack. Once great countries like England and France are shadows of what they once were due to the invasion of radical Islamists. And politicians without backbones are doing nothing about it. Selwyn Duke joins us today to talk about this cultural invasion going on not only in Europe, but in the United States as well.
Hi, Michael. Great to be with you again. Michael, today I want to talk about the cultural colonization of the West and why we allow it to happen. And a good example of this phenomenon is the Islamization of Europe, which, although we wouldn't know it listening to the mainstream media, is occurring at a faster rate than anyone imagined. And not only that, the same threat looms here in America, because we're following in the old world's footsteps. When pondering this problem, I think of how one of man's tragic faults is that he tends to swing from one extreme to the other. Just look at Europe, for instance. Its nations have transitioned from chest-pounding nationalism to chicken-chested internationalism, from the colonization of exotic civilizations to inviting the colonization of their dying ones. And, as a result, they're doing more to fulfill Saladin's dream than that Muslim conqueror ever could. These are the findings of Jesse Petrilla, a journalist who just returned from a trip to Europe during which he investigated a demographic force that, as Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi said, may grant Islam victory, quote, without swords, without guns, without conquests, unquote. Writing at frontpagemagazine.com, Petrilla reports that Paris, France has no-go zones, which are, quote, Islamic neighborhoods where police absolutely refuse to enter, and where if you're not Muslim and you're caught driving through it, you will have bricks thrown at your car and may not make it out alive, unquote. He then tells of a new police chief who, quote, decided he wanted to crack down on the no-go zones and send his police in, against the wishes of many other authorities. When the police entered one of the large 15-story commie block-style apartment buildings, someone pushed a refrigerator off the roof onto one of the squad cars. They don't go in there anymore. Unquote.
Even the police are backing down?
I know, Michael. Really brave, huh? Now, not surprisingly, this weakness emboldens the Muslims to wreak havoc beyond their enclaves. For example, Petrilla attended a Hamas and Hezbollah rally that swelled to at least 15,000 screaming, violent jihadis who burned American and Israeli flags and became so threatening that the journalist finally had to leave the scene. Moreover, Petrilla writes that on the first day of his trip, quote, local news reported that another synagogue was firebombed, a fourth that week, and a man had just been stabbed for wearing a Star of David by the notorious disenfranchised youths, as the media calls them. 2 days prior, there was a peace rally, which resulted in the burning of dozens of cars, again, by those pesky youths, who for some reason yell Allah Akbar while rioting, unquote. Yet, such passion is conspicuously absent among native Frenchmen who, even after 60 years, haven't lost the spirit of Vichy, writes Petrilla. Quote, an unnamed source explained that during a recent protest, someone began shooting at the police with a handgun. The officer in charge gave the order to his men not to return fire and was given an award by the government for his restraint. Unquote.
An award for not defending themselves? Might as well surrender.
Yeah, Michael, I know. They're just waving the white flag, I guess. Now, in Holland, the situation is much the same, with no-go zones in cities and a striking lack of assimilation. Petrilla reports that in metropolitan areas, about 50% of the youths are now Muslim, and while observing a class from a typical Dutch school, he estimated that approximately 30% of the girls were wearing the Muslim head covering, the hijab. Additionally, Sharia law is already being instituted in some Muslim areas, and as a result, crimes in such places often are not reported to Dutch authorities. They are instead handled by local religious leaders who administer their own punishments.
Oh my God.
When analyzing this sad state of affairs, where should we place the blame? Well, this really is a situation where we can quote the comic strip character Pogo and say, we have met the enemy and he is us. Sure, Dar al-Islam has had designs on the West for more than a millennium, but it long ago lost the ability to contend with us militarily. More recently, however, we have lost the ability to contend with it culturally. While the Muslim world is characterized by a cultural chauvinism that inspires its more zealous elements to impose their values on others, we're hamstrung by a cultural self-loathing, one that inspires our more traitorous elements to accommodate those very values. And the result is, Islam has no reason to use the sword to subdue us because we use it to commit hari-kari.
Why do we let ourselves commit this cultural suicide?
Well, Michael, that's a good question. I mean, after all, for most of history, the norm was to keep unassimilable foreign elements out of your nation, not invite them in. Now, the quick answer to this question is that multiculturalism is the culprit. But why are we blinded by multiculturalism? Why do we accept its notion that no culture could possibly pose a danger? Well, actually, the problem boils down to what I call the characteristic spiritual disease of our time, moral relativism. To understand this, realize that multiculturalism is a Trojan horse for moral relativism. This is because a tenet of multiculturalism is that all cultures are morally equal. But since different cultures espouse different values, not all cultures can be morally equal unless all values are morally equal. And if you say that all values are morally equal, that's moral relativism. The greatest lie ever told. The lie that there's no truth. In other words, it's the West's spiritual decay, its rejection of God, its atheism that's authoring its demise.
Exactly.
This is because the idea that there's no truth is a corollary of atheism. And a corollary of the proposition that there's no truth is that there's no absolute transcendent moral standard. And once we accept this lie, it logically follows that since there's nothing determining values but man's cultures, there can be nothing above those cultures to use as a yardstick for judging them. Thus, awash in this relativism, the misguided modern man ends up thinking, how can we possibly say one culture is superior to another? One man's meat is another man's poison, right? Who's to judge? To illustrate this point, imagine there was something called animal relativism, the idea that no animal could be any more dangerous than any other. If we believed this, we would then be blind to danger and behave self-destructively. We might let not just a dog or a cat into our house, but also maybe a lion or a black mamba. We might be just as likely to allow our children to pet the Bengal tiger at the zoo as the goat. It would be a recipe for destruction. However, once we understand that moral relativism is a lie, and therefore truth and absolute morality exist, all becomes clear. We then realize that since different cultures do espouse different values, sometimes very different ones, they cannot all be morally equal. And then, when discussing immigration, we'll finally ask the relevant question, which is, will a given cultural force make our nation better or worse? We'll understand that we've got to be careful about what we allow into our national home. Moreover, viewing matters under the light of truth, we may come to realize what I will state unabashedly. Traditional Western civilization is the greatest cultural force to ever grace this earth, and we allow it to be destroyed at our and the world's peril. So, like it or not, a discussion about immigration is nothing less than a discussion about what we want to become, because today's immigration will be tomorrow's culture. Remember, when people come here, they bring their values with them. Unfortunately, though, we don't discuss this much because we're not supposed to. I guess, to many Westerners, politically incorrect discussion is even more intolerable than dimitude or death. Michael, thank you for having me on the show, and God bless you and your audience.
Great point, Selwyn. Too much political correctness will be the death of our nation. We have to be able to talk about the real problems. This is the Savage Nation.